Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Our Matrix server is about as free as internet chat can be. Join the existing rooms or create your own at chat.freetalklive.com. Free Talk Live.
It's Free Talk Live. Welcome to the show. The phones are open, as always. You can bring up anything you want, although right now we are going to reserve calls only for our guests here that we will have with us for the first hour of the show, because I expect we'll be easily able to talk to this guest for an entire hour. His name is Dana Larson. The phone number is 603-283-6160. Dana is fairly well known. Let's call him a drug freedom activist. I'm not sure if that's how he would describe himself, but up in Vancouver, that's in the western side of Canada, where there's been a lot of kind of historic drug freedom activism that has gone on. By the way, in the studio here tonight, it is Ian.
And Chris.
We talked to the Prince of Pot many years ago, Mark Emery, and that was before the federal government here in the United States put him in prison for 5 years for the dastardly crime of selling seeds over the internet. And, Dana, when I was looking into some of your background, I discovered you used to work with Mark over at Cannabis Culture back in the day. Is that right?
Yeah, Mark and I worked together for quite a few years and did a lot of good projects together.
So you've had a long history of doing, let's say, drug freedom activism there in Canada. What got you started?
I've been doing this stuff over 30 years now. I got started in high school, actually. I started smoking pot in grade 11 and grade 12, and I've always been very politically minded. So for a year or two, I would send letters to all of the Canadian members of parliament about drug policy and keep all their answers in a special binder that I had when I was like 19. And when I got to university, I started a club on drug policy and spent 4 years there doing things. And shortly after I graduated, I met Mark and started working together on something that became Cannabis Culture magazine. But I got started because I thought this was one of the most important issues out there. Nobody was really talking about it very much at the time in the late 80s and early 90s. And so I've taken it on as a life path. We got marijuana legalized in Canada, and now we're working on ending the whole war on drugs, which is a pretty big effort.
Yeah, I think I'd come across you at some point, you know, within the last few years, started following you on social media. And then last year, I saw you post something about opening up a mushroom dispensary in Vancouver, but not just mushrooms over time. You ended up adding LSD, DMT, and a coca leaf tea. I mean, you've got all kinds of interesting things that you're making available to the public, basically. Anybody that walks in and joins as a member of this dispensary, this is something that you started doing back when cannabis was illegal as well in Canada, with this sort of idea of kind of putting it out there, even though it was still technically illegal, still something you could be arrested for. But just going right out and renting a place, and I presume, unless you own the building, and just opening up your doors and letting people come in and buy things that the government says you shouldn't be able to buy. So this goes back a ways, right, to the cannabis legalization days, right, this sort of tactic?
Yeah, about 15 years ago, I opened Vancouver's third cannabis dispensary. There'd been two others, but they had been very sort of quiet. They'd been open for about 10 years at that time, but they were very quiet about what they were doing, just trying to help people access cannabis. We had some favorable court decisions in Canada at the time around medical use, so we had patients who were legally allowed to use cannabis but nowhere to access it, which allowed dispensaries to fill in. But what that was a bit different was we very actively taught others how to open their own dispensaries. So I was very public about what we were doing, and we had dozens of people come through, and we would show them everything we were doing about how to open their own place and encourage them to open their own. And as a result, many others opened. in Vancouver and ultimately across Canada. And I really don't think we would have gotten to legalization had there not been hundreds and hundreds of stores all across the country already selling medicinal and social marijuana to people. Sometimes they'd get arrested. Sometimes they'd have police problems. Sometimes not, depending on the city and the jurisdiction and a lot of other factors. But the courts, luckily in Canada, were not willing to put people in jail for very long sentences for selling medicinal cannabis. So it was a lot of work for the police to raid somebody. They'd reopen again the next day. The courts wouldn't punish them very much. That's a perfect formula for mass civil disobedience, which is what we had. And although there's still flaws with how legalization was brought out in Canada for marijuana, I'm trying to use these same tactics now on psychedelics, and ultimately we're going to be expanding to stimulants and opioids and try to create our own safe supply for all these substances in Vancouver and hopefully across Canada.
When you say the courts weren't willing to really dish out any serious punishments, does that mean Canadian juries weren't willing to convict, or did these not go to jury trials? Like, I'm not real familiar with the court system in Canada.
You know, you mentioned Mark Emery earlier, and Mark was selling seeds to Americans by mail order all around the world, actually. Right. But America was the only country that wanted to extradite him. Well, under Canadian law, he should have been charged in Canada with exporting seeds, not sent to a foreign country, which he wasn't in, to face a crime there.
Right.
But in Canada, the courts would have only given him they wouldn't have given him 5 years in jail for selling marijuana seeds. They would have given him a big fine and maybe a short jail sentence. So we basically outsourced our justice system to the U.S.
because
he didn't feel. And that's how it's been on a lot of other things, too. You know, our courts, selling cannabis was against the law, just like I'm breaking the law now selling mushrooms and LSD to people. But the Canadian courts and our precedents that we have the same precedents now around psychedelics and psilocybin. Patients are going to the court saying, look, I need this medicine. I've been traumatized. I'm a veteran. I suffered abuse. Something's happened to me. I need these products to help me live a proper life, and I can't get them legally, and the courts have been sympathetic.
Wow.
And that creates kind of an opening for us when they say, yeah, you're allowed to have psilocybin. Okay, well, where do I get it? How am I supposed to buy it? I can't necessarily don't know how to grow it myself.
Right.
So having stores like ours kind of creates that opening. And I think also being in Vancouver, we have a city that is very pro-drug policy reform.
Mm-hmm.
Our police, unlike a lot of the police in Canada, we have our own police force in our city. And so although, you know, our Vancouver police aren't perfect, they are more responsive to drug policy issues. They are more responsive to the fact that people in Vancouver typically don't want to see stores like mine get shut down. And so they're aware of that. And I think that also helps us to be able to stay open.
Jury trials, I presume, are a thing there in Canada?
Yeah, we have juries and jury trials, and that it depends on the case and everything else. But yeah, we have our legal system is not that different than the U.S.
So there's a chance then that the Vancouver police, they know who you are. I mean, you've been in that town for a long time, right?
Yeah.
So they know if they mess with Dana Larson, you're taking it to trial. You're going to go and you're going to demand a jury, and that jury might actually go in your favor. So it might just be a total waste of their time, and it might actually leave them with some egg on their face.
Well, we have had, I mean, with cannabis, we certainly had many cases where the police would go after people in different cities across the country, and often we would win in court and set some positive constitutional precedences. And some of our major cases went to the Supreme Court. We didn't win every time, but certainly we won a lot when it came to medical cannabis. We won a lot when it came to a lot of these other aspects of these drug laws. And we're winning now, you know, other aspects. The supervised injection site in Vancouver was under threat of being shut down quite a few years ago, and the courts also supported its existence, said it should be there, and forced the government to keep it open. So, you know, we've got a good Charter of Rights in Canada and a good system that's relatively kind of new. We only really got our Charter of Rights in the 1980s, and so a lot of this is still being dealt with in the courts over the years, and that charter really helped us a lot in a lot of these cases.
Over the years, as you've been doing this kind of open-air activism of just offering things for sale that they say you're not allowed to sell, have you been arrested a few times? Have you spent some time behind bars?
You know, I've only ever been arrested for my cannabis activism once.
Huh.
That was actually not in Vancouver. I was giving away free cannabis seeds. I had access to millions of cannabis seeds. I did a thing called Overgrow Canada, where I was going from city to city giving a talk about the history of cannabis in Canada, then giving away seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 23 cities across the country. And on the second stop in Calgary, the police came in. They arrested one of our volunteers. There was actually a woman in Vancouver who is very against what I do. And she was calling all of our venues saying, Dana's going to sell marijuana seeds, and that's giving away marijuana seeds, and that's illegal. And some of them kicked us out of the venue. We had to get new venues. But in Calgary, the police showed up. They arrested one of our volunteers. He was going back to our truck to get more seeds, and they grabbed him. So I came out with, like, there was like a couple of hundred people there for my talk. It was actually a great story. It actually worked out really well. Often being arrested can work out really well, depending on the circumstances. So I went out there, and I said to there was a lot of police there. They had taken this one guy in a truck, and I said, have you arrested somebody here? They said, yeah. I said, well, you should arrest me. It's my event. You can't be arresting my volunteers and not arrest me. I'm the one giving away marijuana seeds. The officer said, well, I don't really want to arrest you. And I said, oh, well, you're gonna. And so I had somebody in the crowd give me some cannabis seeds, and people stuck up their hands. I put cannabis seeds in people's hands. I said, look, there's cannabis seeds in my hand. I just gave seeds to those guys. He said, all right, you're under arrest. But he didn't even, he just walked me across this. It was perfect. It was a huge parking area. He walked me across the whole parking area with my seeds in my hand, 8 cops all around me. The crowd's all yelling, shame, shame, shame. Media frenzy. They take me away. It's a longer story, but they take me away for the night. The next day I get out. Everybody's happy to see me. And because of all the publicity, I was hoping to give away 1 million seeds in the first year. And I wasn't sure if I'd get enough attention to do that. But because of that arrest, I was trending on Twitter. Right. I was national media. I was able to give away 2 million seeds that first year because of that. No other city did the police show up to arrest me. So they helped you out
inadvertently.
It's almost unfortunate, it sounds like, that they didn't arrest you elsewhere.
Right.
Well, if I've been arrested too many times, like when you're on bail and you get arrested again after you're on bail, when it gets serious. So I was worried about that. But every city, the media would ask the police, are you going to arrest Dana? And they'd say, well, we got bigger fish to fry. Mm. We got our eye on it. But it got me so much media. And actually, the next year I did the tour again. And my lawyer said, you can do the tour, but don't go back to Calgary. You're still on bail in Calgary. You haven't had your trial yet. And I was like, okay, I won't go, but I really wanted to go. So I decided to add Calgary last stop to my tour. I go back to Calgary, media frenzy. Are the police going to arrest them? What's going to happen? 2 cops show up to the event. Now the event's ready. They go, if they try to arrest Dana, we're going to link arms around him. We're going to lay down in front of the police cars. So the police go, oh, forget this. They just said, hey, have a good talk. They just left. So we made the police stand down. A great victory.
Nice.
And when it came to trial, ultimately the charges were all dropped. They took too long to get to trial, so it got dropped because of that. No one wanted to deal with it. But, often if you don't get totally shut down, often a police arrest or a police raid can actually be very helpful in terms of getting public opinion on your side, in terms of getting you media attention and awareness. If the police end up, you go to jail for a long time at the end, that's not good. But if it's a case like that, where one night in jail, that was one of the best nights in my life, spend the night in jail. It worked out really well.
That's a great story. It reminds me of years ago, you guys actually at Cannabis Culture reported on some of the 420s that were happening here in Keene, New Hampshire. You guys did a really lengthy report on that. And I was hoping our friend Rich Paul, a.k.a. Nobody, changed his name legally to Nobody to run for governor here in New Hampshire a couple years ago. I was hoping he would be here. Normally he's here with us on Friday nights. He was the guy who was leading the activism here in Keene with those 420s that were happening. And a similar story, the police had come in. There was probably 100-plus people in this little park in Central Square in Keene. Keene's like a 20,000, 25,000 population town. So 100 people in the park's a big deal. And he was, they were smoking up. The cops came in. They arrested, Rich, and they arrested another guy. And they thought that they were going to intimidate their way into shutting down these daily 420s that were happening. And then what happened was 50 people from the park marched down to the police station and proceeded to sit in a big circle out behind the police station and just light up a bunch of joints and pass them around as they were waiting for Rich to get processed out. The next day, the cops came back, made 2 more arrests. And the activists went to the police department again, this time going inside the police department, proceeding to smoke cannabis in the police station lobby. The police did absolutely nothing about that. It made for some really awesome video to see people smoking up inside the police station. And then after that, they didn't come back again.
I wasn't here for that, but that is absolutely the best story, I think, out of Keene.
It was one of the best. Great example.
There's a lot of stories, too. So.
Yeah, of how an arrest can backfire on the police and actually give you an even stronger position, as long as people are willing to continue to make a stand. And that is what you've been doing here over the years in Vancouver, Dana, is you're standing up for drug freedoms and getting people an ability to actually purchase drugs that they need safely. Because as we know with the black market, you really don't know what you're going to get. I mean, thankfully, thanks to folks like Ross Ulbricht, who sadly is spending, you know, two life sentences plus 40 years in prison here in the United States for creating these online drug markets, we've certainly seen a lot of harm reduction in the area of being able to access drugs and actually get what you're expecting to buy. Because the classically on the streets, you don't know what you're going to get. You know, you think you're going to get MDMA, it turns out to be something completely different, something potentially dangerous, and if you're just buying from some shady guy in a club, you have no idea. And there's, you know, it, besides just you're the person selling it, you're also offering a service to people to test drugs. And I want to hear a little bit about that service. When did that start, and what inspired that?
So in 2019, we decided to launch a program called Get Your Drugs Tested. And we bought one of these FTIR machines. It's basically the size of a bread box. It's got a hammer and a little infrared laser. That laser shines down on a very tiny sample of any drug or really any kind of substance. Then it analyzes the light spectrum that comes out, and you can tell what's in there. There's limitations to it, but it's really effective. It only takes about 10 minutes to run a test, and you can find out what's in your drugs. And so we bought one of these machines. We were going to set up, we weren't sure where to set up our operation. The government solved that for us by getting a court order to shut down one of our cannabis dispensaries that had been open for 10 years. So instead of abandoning the location, we reopened it the next day as the Get Your Drugs Tested Center. That was in 2019. So it's been, 4 years now. We've become the world's busiest place to come in and get any street drug analyzed for free. We don't charge anything.
Wow.
It's entirely subsidized by marijuana and now mushroom sales. We probably spent over $1 million on this operation since we began. We're approaching our 50,000th sample tested. We make all of our data available on our website in a free online searchable database at getyourdrugstested.com. So you can go there and search, you know, all the MDMA results or all the cocaine or all the – you can narrow it down quite a bit. We test certainly all kinds of things. We can't test like we can't tell you how much THC is in your marijuana or something, but you know, we analyze chemical drugs. We can detect fentanyl, benzodiazepines, cuts, potency, that kind of thing. And, I'm very proud of this. It's been a lot of work and a lot of effort. But we are, we're now the busiest place in the world doing this. And I think it's very important. Really, I want to go out of business. I don't want us to be needed anymore. People should have their drugs tested before they buy them so they have an accurate label on them saying what's in it, a label they can trust. But I think we're creating a new level of accountability in the drug market in Vancouver because you can't always go back to your dealer. But a lot of times you can go back to your dealer and go, look, you told me this was this. Really, it turned out to be this. And that happens a lot. And often dealers are coming in. They don't know what they're selling. They're buying stuff in large quantities from somebody else. They don't always know exactly what it is. People come in sometimes test 20 samples. You know, they're either a really dedicated hobbyist or they're a provider. And they think that's great.
Yeah, supply chains are a challenge to, you know, make sure you're getting the same thing consistently and reliably, especially when you're sourcing stuff, you know, from overseas. And I'm not in the drug business, but I understand it from an electronics perspective. So
it is a challenge, right? If you're a drug dealer, you don't really want to go to an authority and go, hey, can I test all these samples? I'm going to be selling them to people. Obviously, you want discretion. So it makes it very hard all the way around. So we're very busy. We've been getting busier every day since we opened. And we're doing well over 1,000 tests a month now. We have four of these machines. We have a location. We're about to get a mobile lab set up, a truck we're retrofitting so we can drive around and go to events,
go to concerts, things like that. Yeah, that's a great idea.
And we also take samples by mail too, not just in person, right? So from all across Canada and really anywhere in the world, we don't advocate other countries to send us stuff because we don't want anyone else to get
risky
in trouble. But if it arrives in our mailbox, we will test it and email you or text you back the results. And that mailbox has my name on it. You're sending your samples to Dana Larson, Box, whatever.
That's awesome.
So I think I've received more. I think more people have sent me drugs than anybody else in the world ever. Because I don't think anybody else has received thousands and thousands of people sending them little samples of drugs in the mail like I have. So I've been trying to get Guinness records in on this, but for some reason they're not taking my calls. But
here in the United States, and I believe in Europe, there's the folks, I'm sure you're familiar with Arrowid.org. They're involved with drugsdata.org, used to be ecstasydata.org, and that is a pay per testing. So you pay, you know, 40 or 50 bucks. It might even be up to 100 now with inflation, but, you know, it's, you got to send cash along with, the drug sample. You don't get it back, obviously. And it's all done anonymously when they do it there, but it's done at something called Drug Detection Labs. They can't tell you what the percentages are, let's say you send in an MDMA sample, and they can tell you, yes, it's real MDMA, or yeah, it's MDMA, but it also has this, or it has these other things that doesn't have any MDMA. So they'll tell you what's in it, but there's like a DEA restriction here on actually giving the percentage breakdown or the amount of milligrams or whatever. So you really don't know exactly, you know,
interesting,
if it's 50-50 or whatever. You really can't tell.
I wonder what the restrictions are. Like, what's the logic on that?
It's some DEA restriction on the lab. They're just not allowed to. They can get that information.
Yeah.
They just can't. They can't share it.
Huh.
Does this machine that you guys have give you an actual like breakdown of what is in this sample?
You get a percentage. There are limitations. So if it's under around 5% of the sample, it's hard to pick up. So we also use test strips for things like fentanyl. Because fentanyl might be under 5% of the sample, but still at a level that can cause harm. So we'll use test strips as well for benzos, for fentanyl, to see if it's in there too. We can give a percentage, but it's normally a range. We can't necessarily give an exact one, but we'll say, well, this is about 40 to 50% MDMA, 20 to 30% filler or whatever.
Right.
We can give those kind of ranges, right?
Okay,
but it's hard
cool.
to give it a very precise number, but we can give enough to help the user make an informed decision.
Right.
And often, you know, we find out it's not the drug they thought. They might think it's MDMA. It's really MDA.
Mm-hmm.
Those are often sold interchangeably, even though they're kind of totally similar,
different.
But they're also quite different in a lot of ways too. And,
yeah.
and so we get a lot of that. Sometimes it's a matter of life and death. Other times it's just a matter of it's not quite what you thought it was, or it's been cut. It's been cut with something harmful sometimes that won't necessarily kill you right away, but it's not good for you to be ingesting on a regular basis, right? So with those kind of issues as well. So all those things are things that we look at and try to provide knowledge for people so they know what they're taking.
Yeah, it sounds like a really useful service, especially since you're doing it for free, because that's, you know, that's one of the big, I would say, problems with what we have here in the United States. You know, the average person probably doesn't even know that a service like this exists. The average drug user probably has no idea. And then if they were to say, oh, yeah, you got to pay $40 or $100 just to sample your product that you only bought $50 worth of in the first place, most people aren't going to be able to justify the cost. So I suspect there's a significant number of people who are just declining to do this simply because of the cost issue. Obviously, you're taking donations from people that want to help with this particular project. It's getyourdrugstested.com. Seems like a really, really great harm reduction program you've got going on there, Dana.
Yeah, we do get some donations. I mean, they probably come to less than 5% of our operating budget,
yeah.
right? But we certainly take them. And if anybody out there listening has got an extra $1 million
yeah,
or
sure.
a significant amount of money they want to kick in, we would love to get access to that. You know, we're working on getting this mobile lab going, and it's quite expensive, right?
Yeah,
so we spend a lot on it, but I think it's very much worth it. And trying to set an example for our governments to take this on, right? If they're not going to provide a safe drug supply themselves, at least offer us some free testing so we can get this happening.
Yeah, I don't want the government in charge of drugs. I mean, it's bad right now. It'd probably make it even worse. Hang on, Dana. Stick with us here. We're going to continue this discussion here in moments. We're going to talk more about the mushroom dispensary. We kind of mentioned it earlier, but I want to get into how that's going because it's pretty new. More coming up.
Are you a business owner? Are you confused by the complexity of the tax laws? We can help. I'm Dan Pilla, and I've been helping business owners solve tax problems for over 40 years. My book, The Small Business Tax Guide, shows proven ways to avoid all the common business tax problems. Don't risk your business. Go to danpilla.com to order your copy. That's danpilla.com. Order now and get a free 15-minute call directly with me, a $99 value. Go to danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions, SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs Generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs Generator and Lung Delivery System at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
You USA News Update. Debt limit talks between the White House and Republicans are hitting a snag. Republicans paused negotiations today, saying the White House was refusing to move their way on spending cuts. When asked if meetings could restart Friday, a White House advisor said they're playing by ear. NFL legend Jim Brown is dead at the age of 87. The Hall of Famer retired after 9 years playing with the Cleveland Browns in the 50s and 60s, rushing for over 12,000 yards as well as 106 rushing touchdowns.
I'll tell you, this is a fantastic moment. But I bet you'll never guess why it's so nice for me. I don't think I've ever been at an affair that had the diversity that we have here today.
An employee at a Florida Dollar General is being sentenced to 4 years behind bars for adding bleach to a coworker. Pepsi. Jerome Ellis, the 48-year-old janitor, said he was mad at his coworker for brushing up against him. Dave Collins, USA News.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of seven herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you, so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now, and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit heartdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Tahibo Tea Club's original Pure Pau d'Arco Super Tea comes from the only tree in the world that fungus does not grow on. As a result, it naturally has antifungal, anti-infection, antiviral, antibacterial, anti-inflammation, and anti-parasite properties. So the tea is great for healthy people because it helps build the immune system, and it can truly be miraculous for someone fighting a potentially life-threatening disease due to an infection, diabetes, or cancer. The tea is also organic and naturally caffeine-free. A one-pound package of tea is $49.95, which includes shipping. To order, please visit shopsupertea.com. The first word is shop, spelled S-H-O-P, then the word super, and then the word tea. The complete website is shopsupertea.com or call us at 818-984-6100 Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. California time. That's 818-984-6100. Shopsupertea.com.
We still do email. Drop your email address in the entry box at freetalklive.com and you'll be kept in the loop with Free Talk Live.
For Dana Larson, drug freedom activist in Vancouver, Canada, who's with us. The number here is 603-283-6160. That's 603-283-6160. Free Talk Live, and this hour of the show is brought to you by Dash. It's digital cash. Dash is the cryptocurrency designed to be used for spending. And in addition to being one of the world's first cryptocurrencies, Dash was one of the first, or rather, the first, to have a decentralized, autonomous organization that to this day continues to improve and promote Dash. In fact, every month, 10% of the mining rewards from the Dash miners goes into a treasury, and then anyone who has a whole Dash, which is right now like 40 or 50 bucks, somewhere in that range, can put forward a proposal for the Dash masternodes to vote on. So the masternodes vote, they vet the proposals, they discuss them, they decide whether or not to move forward with them, and then if they do, then that proposal gets funded. In fact, that's how we got this sponsorship from Dash. And nowadays, DAOs are plentiful. You hear about them. If you're in the crypto space, you know about DAOs. They're huge. But Dash did it first, nearly a decade ago. Dash is one of the oldest cryptos. It is widely available on exchanges and in multi-crypto wallets. It's easy to get and use Dash. You can start by learning more at Dash.org. And thanks to the Dash Decentralized Autonomous Organization for sending us 32 Dash per month to promote Dash on the air. You can visit Dash.org and learn about Dash. That is Dash.org. freetalklive.org. Dana Larson is with us here from Vancouver, where we're discussing some of his projects that he's into these days. He's a longtime drug freedom activist there in Canada, having opened up some cannabis dispensaries back in the day before they were even legal, and now doing the same thing with mushrooms and inevitably now also some other psychedelics, which I want to talk about in a moment. But we were just discussing getyourdrugstested.com, which is the preeminent drug testing space in Canada, maybe even one of the most popular in the world. You were saying you guys are processing 1,000 samples every month at just this one location. It's 30-something samples per day, so you guys are definitely busy. I was looking at the website where you have the test results, and, you know, of course, you list what did the person think they were buying, what did they actually end up buying. This is a huge harm reduction project. You may have saved lives here, Dana. It's a very nice thing that you're doing, and as you said, this is being funded through the profits that are being made at the, you know, your store locations, right?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. We originally was all funded by our cannabis sales, and now that our mushroom dispensary is getting busier and generating revenue, we're kicking in from there as well. But I don't think anybody else is doing anything like this in the world. We're actually up to around 1,200 tests a month now. It's getting quite busy. And like I said, we're almost at our 50,000th one tested. But, yeah, it's entirely funded by cannabis, mushrooms, and a little bit of public support, but no money from the government at all.
About what percentage of the testing every day is coming in through the mail versus walk-ins? Just curious.
The mail is probably around 10%, okay. 15% of the total.
Wow.
They've both gone up quite a bit. If you look at the chart, since we started, it's quite a significant upward curve on both of them. And I think there's more potential for the mail in some ways, but absolutely, it's they're both quite busy. But the mail's around 10-15%. You know, although it's free, you've still got to pay to send it in. Obviously, we get the test result back to you the same day we get the sample, but you've got to wait for the mail to arrive. Most right. folks that are getting a drug tested are planning on taking that drug fairly soon after getting their test result. Right? But certainly, you know, the mail, we can reach a lot of places in Canada where they often have less options on who to buy their drugs from. Also, in a real small town or up in the north, a lot less options out there to access, and certainly getting it tested is very difficult.
Now, you said people wait around for the results. Do they get the drug back, or is it consumed?
Yeah, if you want it back, we only require a tiny little, you know, very small head mm-hmm. of a pin kind of sample, but we absolutely do give it back to you if you want it back.
Wow.
That's not a problem at all, and we do return quite a few of them. We don't return them by mail, obviously,
sure.
but if you're there in person, it only takes about 10 minutes to do the test.
It's amazing.
Sometimes there's a lineup, so you might have to wait longer because we're trying to get those done out of the way. So if it's a long wait, we're happy to text you, mm-hmm. call you, email you, or we can give you the results in person on a piece of paper, whatever you like.
Incredible.
I love how you're kind of creating a free market solution to authenticity of the products that you're buying, as opposed to, you know, government doing it through some sort of licensing model.
I mean, if you had a government doing it, it would take you
three months. But we're not. If it was a real free market thing, we'd be making a profit at it, right? And we're not making a profit. So it's more of a charitable action from our service. But I mean,
yeah, okay, fair enough.
The government in BC does offer drug testing. They offer it as well as the service. The province does. They've just been gearing it up. They have about four times as many machines that we have, and they do about one third of all the tests in the province are now done by the government. Two thirds are being done by us, with a quarter of the machines and a tiny fraction of the resources. When the government does drug testing in Canada, it's usually more for academics to be able to judge the trends and write reports about what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's not really geared for drug users so much. And this is about like getting a sample so they can do some kind of academic thing. And for me, it's not about academics. It's about drug users being able to know what they're getting.
Right, and survive it. Getting some bad stuff, not taking the bad stuff.
Yeah.
This is a huge harm reduction thing. And I suspect the government's not going to give you a 10-minute turnaround either. You send it in the
mail. No, actually, a lot of them, they'll pick it up on Thursdays. You get your results back on a Saturday. If you drop it off on a Monday, it could be a five-day wait to get your results back. And so, yeah, they're not as busy. The people working there, like, would like to do more. So we actually also provide the training. To learn how to use one of these machines, you've got to spend a fair amount of time shadowing somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're the only place busy enough, we're providing the training for people who ultimately go on to work for the government lab, because if they try to train on the government machines, they're not doing enough tests. It takes them forever to get their hours in. So we're actually, in a way, subsidizing the government's efforts on our end.
So you opened up a mushroom dispensary, what, a couple years ago? When did that get started?
Yeah, well, we about 3 years now. Mm-hmm. We opened it originally as a coca leaf cafe, and then we brought in mushrooms a little later, and then we added LSD and DMT and other psychedelics. We sell peyote as well. We also sell a herb called kratom, which you're probably familiar with, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But kratom is kind of an illegal gray area in Canada, but it's fairly useful for those who want to substitute for opiates.
Right.
So we're the only place in the world that – we're not the only mushroom shop, but we're the only place in the world you can walk in the door and buy mushrooms, LSD, and DMT. We're also the only place in the world, including South America, that's really focused on, like, coca leaf, being able to go in and buy coca leaf. And we've developed a lot of coca tea drinks, kind of making coca like espresso. So we make, like, a really potent coca extract kind of called coca brew, and then we use shots of that to make various drinks. You can get a cocachino or a sparkling coca soda or any of
that's
these kind
awesome.
Of things. And, you know, it's a challenge. In fact, the coca, although the mushrooms and the psychedelics are the biggest part of our business, the coca is the hardest part because, unlike those things, no, we don't grow coca in Canada. I've got to import, smuggle coca leaves and coca flour in from South America. And obviously, all the time I think, if I was smuggling cocaine, this would be way easier. But the leaves are bulky, and that's, you know, but no one else is really bringing it in. But we're able to make coca tea and provide coca leaf to chew. And for me, a lot of this is about, I mean, I believe cocaine and synthetics should be legalized, but I also really think a lot of it's about plant medicines, and that at their root, these things are originally plant medicines that really we should be returning to that kind of mode of use where you get the greatest benefit and the least risks. And so, you know, coca leaf, opium poppies, cannabis flowers, peyote cactus, psilocybin mushrooms, these are all plants or plants and fungi that have millennia of social, cultural, medicinal, spiritual use and really should be reintroduced in those forms. And like I said, I think all forms should be legal, but users will tend to go towards the milder forms when given the option. You know, now that cannabis is becoming more legal and available, what's the biggest growth area? CBD.
Mm-hmm.
Now that psychedelics are becoming more available, what's the biggest growth area? Microdosing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if we
legalize cocaine tomorrow, the big money would not be in selling cocaine powder any more than the big money in caffeine is in selling caffeine powder. The big money in cocaine would be coca-based drinks, putting the cocaine back in Coca-Cola, making alternatives to coffee. That would become the number one form of coca ingestion in the world.
Yeah.
Snorting cocaine would be about as popular as snorting caffeine if we put them both on the same playing field.
That's a really excellent point. You know, drug criminalization, prohibition, as we've seen over the years, drives people to use the harder drugs. It drives the manufacturers, the people willing to take the risk of selling those drugs to the harder stuff because, you know, if you only have so much space to move something across the border in a truck or whatever, you want to move the stuff that's the most valuable. You want to use, you know, you want to move the highest potency product. And so that's as a result, that's what gets pushed. You know, I think it's a really great observation that given a legal status, given when people aren't afraid of going to prison, they're going to actually move towards the lower intensity use. I think it's a great point. So you introduced mushrooms at a dispensary a few years ago, and it was just late last year, right, that you decided to add LSD, DMT, and what was the other? There's a third one, right? What's the other thing you popped
in? LSD, we saw DMT,
mushrooms.
I feel like there's one more. Coca, kratom,
okay.
Peyote cactus.
Peyote,
we sell that
okay.
as well. We sell dried and live peyote.
So that's
sometimes I forget all the things we sell. It's a pretty long
it's
list.
A heck of a menu.
We also sell like other. You know,
We sell some other
synthetic things as well, and different kinds. Some of them are quasi legal or whatever, but those are the main ones.
So you added the extra products. It was late last year, right? So these are pretty new because the mushrooms have been there for a few years now, and you decided you were going to add in LSD and DMT.
They're all on the same drug schedule in Canada, so I figured, you know, if we were going to sell something in Schedule 3, like a mushroom, why not sell a Schedule 3 LSD as well?
Ah, okay. That was going to be my next question, because there was a story in, let's see if I've got it here, CBC.
The drugstore.
CA, yeah, the mobile drugstore in Vancouver decided to open his doors and sell cocaine and heroin, methamphetamine, apparently crack, out of a mobile trailer, and he got raided right quick. So are those Schedule 1 drugs in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, I know that guy fairly well, and I support what he's doing, and he was definitely taking a big risk.
No doubt.
But I think you gotta, I mean, when people try to buy psychedelics from us, they do have to show ID. Mm-hmm. They've got to sign a little form that they're going to be a responsible user. They're not going to go swimming or driving using the substance. We don't require that for alcohol, of course, in this country,
sure.
But I thought, well, it's better to have a bit of a protocol. You know, I'm all for selling heroin to adults that need it, but I'd probably make them have a membership and screen them a little bit, especially mm-hmm. when you're the first guy doing it in the world. I think he's the only guy who's ever tried to do a shop like this, as far as I know.
Wow.
You know, and then you can loosen those rules over time as you get experienced, as people get used to it. So I'm all for selling heroin to adults who need it and for
sure.
selling cocaine to those who want it and need it. But yeah, if I was him, I would have probably had a bit more of a screening process involved, but I'm not sure that would have stopped them getting arrested.
No,
you know, but we'll see. He's not given up yet. He's got plans to come back and do more. And so he's still active, but
what is schedule?
In
Canada, schedule 3, let's say the worst happens and the Vancouver cops or, you know, the state police, whatever the equivalent of that is, national RCMP, they come in there to your shop and put you in handcuffs, shut the operation down. Would you be getting charged with felony drug distribution, do you think? I mean, what would the worst case scenario
be? We don't call it a felony. We don't call them felonies and misdemeanors in Canada, but it would be considered an indictable offense in Canada. That's sort of like a felony compared mm-hmm. to what we call a summary conviction, which would be a misdemeanor. No, I could face many years in prison. I mean, I'm selling a wide variety of stuff is my money laundering, because any handling of money that was based on it. I mean, we pay our taxes. We don't really launder money, but just the fact that
yeah.
we're taking in money from drug sales and then spending it on groceries or whatever, that's money laundering under the
right.
thing. We'd be considered an organized crime organization when you got more than two people conspiring to break the law. So me and my staff or my management, that's a conspiracy. So, you know, maximum penalties would be quite a few years in prison in some quite severe sentence. But you know,
so
I
far,
think that
so good.
Yeah, but I think that a judge might recognize that I'm not, you know, I'm not in this as a selfish kind of a profiteering kind of thing, that we take a lot of efforts to make sure that people are using these things responsibly, that we're mm-hmm. directing the money that we raise into things that help the community. That doesn't give you an excuse to break the law, but it does affect you when it comes to sentencing and how you are perceived by the court. But we would challenge it to the Supreme Court, and there's a good chance we would be able to have some victories along the way and potentially change some of these laws. You know, we've got a lot of good legal arguments behind it. In Canada, I think we've got a lot of precedents, and certainly I would fight legally as long as we could. But yeah, if the police really wanted to come after me and the courts really wanted to punish me, I do certainly have a risk to my freedom and liberty here that's not insubstantial.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there, like, a bill, any bills that are proposed in terms of moving things forward, or that's not your...
You mean like a national level in Canada?
I don't know. Is it a national, or is this province-based?
Provincial.
Well, it kind of breaks down, you know. Ultimately, all three levels of government play a big role, right? And, like, the decision to come after me or not is about the Vancouver police. They don't really do what they're not supposed to respond politically to the mayor and the city council. They're supposed to be independent, but they take the city tenor into consideration, I think. The province in British Columbia, we just decriminalized in British Columbia possession of 2.5 grams of MDMA, methamphetamine,
wow.
cocaine, heroin, and opioids,
okay.
but not like psychedelics like mushrooms or things like that. So it was only things that could potentially be contaminated with fentanyl that they've decriminalized. It's kind of a weird thing. But that was between the province and the federal government kind of mm-hmm. doing it together. Ultimately, the criminal law in Canada is federal, but the provinces have a lot of power to how they enforce things, how they prioritize. You know, the province declared a health emergency over the overdose crisis in British Columbia, which allows them to operate harm reduction sites that sort of defy federal law. Even our place, Get Your Drugs Tested, we actually have permission from the health authority in British Columbia. We're designated as an overdose prevention site, which allows our staff to handle illegal drugs.
Mm-hmm.
We would do it anyways, of course, and we
sure.
started before we got that permission. But if they're going to give us permission, great. But that allows us to handle illegal drugs under this emergency situation. So all levels of government are involved. But there is talk at the federal level about psychedelics, but I think Trudeau and our current Liberal government, they legalized marijuana in 2018. That took a lot of political capital. It took years of figuring out rules and having to buy off all the different stakeholders and get everybody onto it. Psychedelics are way harder because it's not just mushrooms. You've also got to regulate LSD and DMT. And they had enough trouble coming up with the rules for marijuana, which are very discriminatory and punitive. better than prohibition, but they're still terrible rules, right, with a lot of punishments. And I think to them, the daunting task of trying to not only do mushrooms, but like all psychedelics, is to feel like they're not going to want to do it right away. So I think it's going to be like with cannabis, we're going to get de facto legalization where we end up with hundreds of shops across the country, the odd raid here and there, courts kind of going back and forth, but not really willing to punish anybody. And it more becomes an effort by police, a game of whack-a-mole where they come in and take your stuff, take all your money, harass your staff, maybe put you on bail for a while. No one goes to jail in the end, but it's still a big hassle, and not everybody can take that kind of pressure. So I think we're going to see that happening, just like with cannabis. We're going to see, and we're seeing it now. There's a few shops in Toronto that got raided recently. People have been opening mushroom shops in Hamilton, a city in Ontario. Some of them have gotten raided. They're reopening again. So, you know, Vancouver's kind of a safer area, but otherwise it varies widely across the country. Some cities are cool. Some small towns don't mind. Other places are really active where the police really come in day one, try to arrest them. So, but they're not going to be able to stop us. We're going to see a massive growth over the next 5 years of these psychedelic shops across the country.
I mean, kudos to these people who are willing to put their freedom on the line for the freedoms of others to be able to put what they want in their bodies. I mean, this is the risks that you guys are taking is absolutely incredible, and I really appreciate it. It sets an example, and of course, when people see a good example like that, they're more likely to emulate it. I was looking at a story in the Vancouver Sun about the cafe that you have, which is the Coca Leaf Cafe. Now, is that part of the mushroom dispensary? Are they the same building? What's that? You know, how's
same
it?
Space, same okay. space. Basically, on the one side we have the cafe part, the other side we have the mushroom dispensary part. So you can come in, get a Coca tea, get a sandwich and a cookie or a bag of chips or whatever, hang out. It's a nice space to hang out. We got a lot of beautiful art on the walls. Or you can just come in, buy what you need, and leave. So it's all one location. We've got a second location for our mushroom dispensary we just opened in a very busy kind of area downtown. Our first shop is kind of in the downtown east side of Vancouver, which is sort of on the edge of what's a lot of homeless people, some street tents, that kind of thing. Our second location is in a very busy kind of urban area, and we're looking at expanding to other spots in the city. But the Coca Leaf Cafe and the mushroom dispensary, that's one location together.
They said here in this article that the city of Vancouver issued some sort of a notice to quote-unquote cease illegal activity, claiming that the sale of psilocybin products is not permitted and they can't issue a license. What happened with that? Did they continue to escalate the threats? Are you in the midst of some sort of a case? Where'd that go, if anywhere?
We've actually got a court case coming up next Friday, 1 week from today. But basically, when we open cannabis dispensaries, they often would not get a business license. You would just open your location, and then the city would come after you eventually, and with their weakness was you don't have a business license. We don't care what you're selling. Trying to get into the whole medical marijuana argument, they were losing that. But they win the argument, no business license, we shut you down. And eventually they got an injunction against a lot of dispensaries after years in the courts. So for this place, we got a business license. I opened as a cafe. We got a business license as a cafe and retail. Then we added in some retail, which was the psychedelics. So now the question is more about, well, we have a license, but are we operating within that license? And it's a very different legal question that I think we have a lot stronger case on. But the city kind of felt that we tricked them, I guess, by getting a license and then introducing some of the psychedelics. So they're claiming we don't have a license, but that's not true. But we'll see what happens in court next week. But, you know, the result of this court case will not be like either we're shut down or we're totally free to do whatever we want. It's the beginning of a long stage of many court battles over many years. The end result of this series of court battles, probably in a worst-case scenario, maybe we have to pay a fine or something. And in a best-case scenario, we win against the city and they're forced to leave us alone, which would be an amazing precedent for other shops. The city of Vancouver has the power to give a license to a shop selling an illegal drug. And we know this because before cannabis was legalized, they licensed many cannabis dispensaries. So many were opening, they were losing control. They said, well, we at least want to put some rules in place. We at least want to keep them from being right next door to a school or from there being three on the same block. So they wrote some bylaws about cannabis dispensaries years before they were legal. So they have the power to do that. They could license mushroom shops, they can license heroin compassion clubs if they want to at the civic level without changing the federal law. That's what I was saying. Every level of government is involved, right? So the Vancouver government has the power to even do these things if they want to. Doesn't mean we're not breaking federal law, but it really sets a precedent within the city. But we'll see what happens. They're pretty nervous about, you know, the city council really just wants to pretend we're not here.
Sure.
And ignore it. Because whatever side they take on it, they're going to get people complaining at them, right? So they try to not, to try to avoid it. And they, that happened with cannabis. They avoided it with cannabis because there was 100 shops in the city. And they were like, ah, we got to do something. Where do those all the shops come from? And now we're at the same stage. They're ignoring it now. There's about 10 shops in Vancouver now. Two of them are mine. There's going to be 50 by the end of this year.
10 shops, just to clarify.
Going, oh, where did all these shops come from? Selling mushrooms.
Mushrooms, okay. Right.
Yeah, nice. No one else, as far as I know, is selling LSD, although I wouldn't be surprised if some start imitating me. They mm-hmm. see what Dana's doing, nothing happens to him.
Right.
Hopefully they'll start doing it too, which means more competition for me, but also means a freer country, so I'm all for that.
Well, right, you know, that's what you were saying before, was you were helping people back in the day learn how to sell the cannabis, because you want to have more people out there. You want to have more locations.
Yeah.
The more people that are doing this, the safer everyone is.
I mean, most businesses don't operate like that by setting up their competitors
sure.
to that, but, you know, we have a different attitude, right? So.
Yeah. It is amazing. And the website here, getyourdrugstested.com, mushroomdispensary.com. Of course, you have your own site, which is Dana Larsen, DanaLarsen.com. What's one of the biggest challenges running a mushroom dispensary?
Well, I mean, for me, the coca leaf is probably one of the biggest challenges.
Sourcing,
but when it comes sourcing that stuff. But when it comes to mushrooms, I think it's really just being able to explain to people all the different strains and varieties and how they all differ, you know. It's like we have 12 different strains of mushrooms. It takes quite a while to go through each one with people. Also, it's having a good landlord, I think, is a key issue as well, because landlords come under a lot of pressure from the city, and they're kind of the weak link in the chain.
Right.
So when they tell your landlord, oh, we're going to give you a $100,000 fine, and maybe you'll go to jail, even though it's probably an idle threat, most landlords just cave, right? Because they're not activists. They just want to get their rent paid.
Looking to make money.
So I've been lucky to have some really good landlords that can handle the pressure.
Wow.
Sometimes I have to put money aside. Say, look, our lawyer's got $40,000 in a vault for you. If you ever get fined, here's the thing I'm signing, saying we'll pay that fine out of that money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to make our landlords safe. But having a good landlord is really key to running this kind of business.
Makes sense. I hope people could take some lessons from this. Keep an eye on Dana Larsen. Follow him. He's on Twitter at Dana Larsen. You're also on Mastodon. Is that right?
Oh, wow. I got a Mastodon account. I think I've only Mastodoned a few times. You know, we'll see if I keep it up there. But for better or worse, I'm still mainly on Twitter.
All right. Well, we've got to get you set up with one of those Mastodon auto posters.
Yeah.
That way you can post to Mastodon and have it shoot over to Twitter. That way you get them both.
That'll be handy. Yeah. Social media, having too many, it becomes complicated.
I hope to hear good news about the court case, Dana. Thank you for joining us here tonight on Free Talk Live. Really appreciate the insight.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thank you. That's Dana. Dana Larsen from DanaLarsen.com, MushroomDispensary.com, GetYourDrugsTested.com. Wish I could visit Vancouver, but I'm not allowed to leave New Hampshire. If I could, I'd love to check that out. More coming up. Hour 2's on the way.
No matter where you live, what you make, or who you voted for, there are some things that will impact all of us soon. Whether you're concerned about the alarming increase in man-made disasters, financial institutions collapsing, or worsening food shortages, Americans are preparing in numbers not seen since World War II. What's changed is how we prepare. And the folks at My Patriot Supply have made it easier than ever for you to have peace of mind, knowing you're ready for what's next. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and stock up on over a dozen emergency food kits. These include tasty breakfasts, lunches, dinners, drinks, fruits, veggies, meats, and snacks, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one kit per person. As we all know, calories equals energy equals survival. My Patriot Supply food kits are in stock and shipped discreetly. We've seen too many Americans let down by institutions we used to trust. It's time to rely on ourselves. MyPatriotSupply.com. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Every day we take steps to keep the people we love safe. But some health risks are easy to miss. Ticks hiding in the yard can spread germs that can cause Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Mice searching for sources of food can spread bacteria and disease. Mosquitoes breed in standing water and can transmit illnesses like West Nile virus and Zika virus. Cockroaches are drawn to water in the home and can leave behind allergens that trigger asthma attacks. Stinging insects attack in defense of their nests and send more than 500,000 people to the emergency room every year. Household pests are a threat to our health. Learn what you can do to protect your family at pestworld.org.